So we're kind of entering a kind of a wild west, and we've been in it for a while, but it's getting wilder, and finally people are waking up that we need to do something about all these platforms.
Welcome to the GeekWire podcast. I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop. One of the first books that I read as a newspaper reporter starting out on the tech beat in Seattle almost two decades ago now was called Microsoft Secrets. It was a juicy read, and it helped me understand how the company really worked. It also provided some important context for the antitrust case that unfolded against Microsoft in the years after the book was published. Well, the co-author of that book was Michael Cusimano. He's a professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management, and he's published more than 120 articles and columns and 14 books focused primarily on the business of technology. The books include Platform Leadership, Competing on Internet Time, and a new book, The Business of Platforms, Strategy in the Age of Digital Competition, Innovation, and Power, with his co-authors Annabelle Gower and David Yoffe. The book examines the hidden forces powering some of today's most powerful and influential companies, including Amazon, Uber, Google, Facebook, and Microsoft. I caught up with Michael Cusimano recently about the new book, and as you'll hear in our conversation, the subject of platforms and their inherent power is especially timely right now, given the current scrutiny of many of those companies. Michael Cusimano, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Happy to be here with you.
Great. Well, I'm enjoying your new book. And as I mentioned, I've obviously been reading your work for years. Many people in our audience are familiar with the concept of a platform, this idea of an enabling set of technologies that companies and organizations build their products on. Why should people care about or read about platforms? Why do they matter in today's world?
Platforms matter because there's probably nothing you do during the day that doesn't bring you into contact with one of these platforms. And, you know, they in many ways have this great influence on the services we use, whether it's, an Uber car to get somewhere or an Airbnb room where we stay, or your finding these services or looking for information or buying something using your smartphone, which is a platform, and you have choices between Google and Apple and various other companies that partner with the Google Android platform. So just platforms are everywhere, and they're also in video streaming and what you see on your television, what you hear on your radio, the music you enjoy, how you buy your food. Eventually, we're going to have financial services dominated by different kinds of platforms, peer-to-peer transactions, for example, or secure quantum communications or new cryptography approaches, or healthcare being moved to a platform where you have, you know, personalized medicine. So really, platforms are everywhere, and they're part of the everyday fabric of life. And that's why we need to think about them, because some of them become so powerful that they create room for abuse, and they need to be regulated. And we also need to understand as consumers what we're buying.
It's interesting because you and your co-authors make a distinction in your new book between innovation platforms and transaction platforms, and it's an important distinction. What's the difference?
So there is a big difference. Innovation platforms are, let's say, technological foundations that bring together users with outside creators of what we call complementary innovations. In other words, in the case of a smartphone, those would be third-party software apps. In case of an operating system, also they would be applications. And you have some other examples as well. Transaction platforms are also bringing together different market actors, but for the most part, they're bringing together buyers and sellers or something resembling that. And as you mentioned, I've been studying platforms for a very long time, at least 25 years, probably even 30 years. But I first used the word platform in the sense of this innovation platform with Microsoft in a book, Microsoft Secrets, 1995. And actually, Microsoft referred to its operating systems as a platform. Then another book, Platform Leadership, in 2002, were really about these innovation platforms. But roughly from the Internet or the web period, the late 1990s, other businesses have come about that also are bringing together these different market sides and growing their business through network effects. And it is in some ways similar to the innovation platforms, but quite different. So that's why we decided to create two different labels. And we think all platforms fall into one of these two categories.
An innovation platform is in some ways more powerful, it seems like, based on my read.
Yeah, there's really almost no limit to what could be built on top of an innovation platform. The other important point that we make in the book is that the most valuable companies in the world, and in many ways the most powerful platforms, are really hybrid companies. In other words, they do both. So one of the things that makes Facebook so scary, let's say, is that, yes, it started out as a transaction platform, essentially just bringing together people who want to communicate or share information with each other. We consider that a transaction, even though it may be priced at zero. But Facebook platform, launched from around 2007, opens up APIs and lets outside companies build specific applications, games, connect websites that let the users do all sorts of things on Facebook, some of which have not been particularly well controlled. So it's really adding the innovation platform side to transaction platforms that has made some of them extraordinarily powerful.
As you're saying, you can't neatly categorize one company or another into an innovation platform or a transaction platform category. But what are some examples of divisions of these companies that fall into one category or another?
So Apple iOS operating system is a pretty clear example of an innovation platform. But when Apple opened up the App Store, essentially, that is a transaction platform. It's bringing together users with those third-party application developers. And Apple is also taking 30% of the revenue, so they're making money on that transaction of bringing users together with the outside complementers. But it's also making the innovation platform more powerful, again, creating network effects between the applications and the app developers and the users itself. So you'll find pretty much every innovation platform company has now copied that model and created an app store. And you'll also see a lot of the transaction platforms have done what Facebook has done. They've opened up an innovation side, allowing third parties to come in with B2B or sometimes B2C services. Uber and Airbnb are doing that, for example, to compete more effectively with other transportation companies or hotels.
Why is it important for different people in the market, competitors, regulators, customers, to understand this distinction between these innovation and transaction platforms? And should they be treated differently by different constituencies out there in the world?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, one reason why it's important is because platforms are everywhere now. They're in every aspect of our life. And so it's not just smartphones and PCs, but it's the millions of different kinds of things we do with those devices. And again, there are other kinds of platforms coming on stream that don't necessarily rely on smartphones or personal computers, things like quantum computing or CRISPR editing technology. We also have self-driving car technology. So there's a lot of different kinds of innovation platform competition occurring, and also transaction platform competition occurring. So understanding what they are is important for competition. So many established firms are going to be threatened by these platforms. And platform entrepreneurs are incredibly numerous. So we looked at the unicorns, is 250 or so of those. These are billion-dollar companies that are not yet public, and about 60 to 70% of those are platforms. So we have platforms coming in just about every industry and every technology. So we need to understand what they are, and that's in terms of users, competitors, established competitors, entrepreneurs, who are working with digital technologies. And then we have the issue of government regulation and governance of these platforms. So we're kind of entering a kind of a wild west, and we've been in it for a while, but it's getting wilder, and finally people are waking up that we need to do something about all these platforms.
it's no coincidence that all of the four companies who were appearing before the U.S. House Judiciary Committee recently, they were all platform companies of one type or another: Facebook, Google, Amazon, and Apple. And I'd be curious to know if you have any takeaways from those current proceedings or those current inquiries into those companies as viewed more through the lens of platform economics and competition.
Yeah, well, we've followed it closely, and we added a chapter in our book called Double-Edged Swords, harness platform power, but don't abuse it. And most of the books written about platform companies, including some of my earlier work as well, really didn't look at the potential abuse side. So platforms create quite a few problems for regulators, because some of them have great market power, and this could mean up to 90 or 95% market shares. Now, in those cases, it's a little bit clearer when platforms abuse those positions. So one of the other issues that come up with platforms is what we call winner-take-all or most dynamics. The fact that these are businesses, whether they're innovation or transaction platforms that rely on network effects, network effects are these self-reinforcing positive feedback loops. And so they tend to result in one or two big winners in markets where things play out correctly. They don't always play out that way, but often they do. But having a huge market share by itself is not illegal. That is, a company has to abuse that position. And we write about what we learned from the Microsoft antitrust case, where Microsoft did abuse its position with Windows, very clearly trying to crush or harm, let's say, PC makers that wanted to load a competing browser, or later on Microsoft tying Windows to other products that it bundled into Windows, like a media player. So we do have a lot of precedents, 20 years of precedents, for how governments are likely to regulate companies that abuse a market position. But there is no one market position that kind of triggers activity. It's really the abuse, in essentially harming competitors or harming choice for users or crossing from one market to another, which is considered a kind of abuse. It gets difficult in the transaction platforms because it's not quite so clear what their markets are. In the innovation platforms, we can say, okay, the market is smartphone operating systems or PC operating systems. But in transaction platforms, you know, is something like search a market, or is online commerce a market? And, you know, Amazon might move into groceries, scaring the hell out of every grocery chain in the world, as well as small mom-and-pop shops. But in aggregate, it only has about 4% market share in groceries. So it really doesn't trigger antitrust. And even in terms of online commerce, it still has less than 50% of online commerce in the U.S., and globally it's even less, including China. So traditional ways of thinking about the economics of antitrust and market power don't always apply to platforms, because platforms, and whether they're innovation or transaction platforms, but especially transaction platforms, they're really built on data. And the data crosses markets. So Amazon can understand user behavior or purchase behavior in a lot of different markets where it may have very little share. And so one of the issues in the antitrust investigation of Amazon is it abusing the information it has on Amazon Marketplace to offer its own competing products with third parties who are using Amazon Marketplace, and sometimes it makes acquisitions using that information also.
I'm speaking this week with Michael Cusimano, co-author of the book The Business of Platforms. After the break, we'll dive deeper into our discussion of Amazon as a platform.
Technology moves fast. I need to move faster. WGU's competency-based education puts me in control of how fast I move through my IT degree program. I can accelerate my program by applying what I already know to my courses and focusing on the things I need to learn. Earn a respected accredited degree that propels your career in the IT field. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT Certs Included.
To to me, one of the key insights from your book was that by categorizing the different components of these companies into innovation or transaction platforms, I was able to think, okay, now I have a better grasp of their motivation as an organization from these different drivers inside their businesses. But with Amazon, it's like, okay, where is the motivation coming? And of course, they would say, and this kind of makes my eyes roll sometimes, they say it so much, but they would say, oh, it's the customer. That's always our motivation. And I realize that's a lot of sort of PR work that they're doing there in part. Although if you talk to people inside, maybe they're drinking the Kool-Aid, but they say that's the North Star. At any rate, how do you wrap your mind around Amazon these days?
So again, we write quite a bit about Amazon. I've followed Jeff Bezos pretty closely, and not only this book, a prior book I did, Strategy Rules, about the thinking of Bill Gates, Andy Grove, and Steve Jobs. We also wrote a bit about Jeff Bezos. He's clearly a remarkable guy, and people born in his generation basically grew up thinking platforms and digital, so they were not traditional product people anyway. I mean, they grew up in the world of personal computers, certainly, but Bezos, like Bill Gates, was exposed to programming in like junior high school or high school. So they see the world through software and how to put different pieces together, how to use digital technology kind of drives him. I think they are centered on the customer, but it's really centered on selling to the customer everything that a customer needs from the time they get up in the morning and make their coffee and have breakfast until they go to bed at night and everything they've done during the day. So the only thing I can figure out that drives Jeff Bezos is volume. He just loves volume, and it's selling anything and everything to customers. And Prime Membership Club is an example of that. So one of the things that we talk about in the book, that one of the things that prevents a winner-take-all market is what the literature calls multi-homing, that users can use more than one platform for the same purpose. And when that happens, markets fragment, and you don't have these really powerful network effects. So it hasn't really happened in PCs. It really hasn't happened too much in smartphones. We talk smartphone business essentially tolerates two platforms, Apple and Google. Google has about 80%. But in online retail, there's really nothing to prevent someone from going to multiple websites or the company websites themselves that are selling different products or services. So Amazon creates a buyer's club, essentially, with discounts and special benefits to get people to go to Amazon for anything and everything that they want. And what do people spend most of their money on? It's things like groceries. So that's why you see, I think, Jeff going into groceries and trying to digitize the grocery business. Which brings me to another point, which I think is one of the main lessons of this book and something that we thought about, but it's really clear here, that platformizing a bad business doesn't make it a good business. And you know, groceries is not a good business. It's a low-margin business, and so is the taxi business. And platformizing those businesses does not create the same kind of profits that you would see in selling digital goods, like you see with Microsoft selling software. So I think many people misunderstood that. So we have these hundreds and thousands of platforms appearing in almost every business, and yes, they are operating off smartphones and the internet, but ultimately many of them are still selling a physical service. The ones that are not, the ones that are really just in digital businesses like Facebook or Google or Microsoft, are still making tons of money, and the more money they make, the more money they make. But that's not quite the case with Amazon for most of the businesses it's gone into. So in the case of Amazon, they make some money on these transactions, and the huge volume they could go into if they're selling everything. Certainly, you know, volume has some benefits too. Even 1% of $1 trillion ends up being a big number. But they really make money off a pure digital service, which is Amazon Web Services. That's their money-making machine, and that's enabled Jeff Bezos to diversify into so many different businesses. But ultimately, Amazon will just be representative of the world internet economy, and if that's not growing very much, then neither will Amazon.
Microsoft is a company you've paid close attention to over the years, as we've been saying. But what's amazing about Microsoft's position right now is that they bungled the smartphone era. That's the word I would use. And Windows Phone is a central subject in your chapter on common mistakes for platforms. How is it possible that Microsoft has missed this key phase of the tech revolution and is still the most valuable company somehow, the most valuable company in the world, not just the most valuable tech company in 2019?
Well, I think they are the most valuable company because of two things. One, for the most part, they sell digital goods, and where the marginal cost of reproducing those goods is extraordinarily high. So they can have gross margins of 70, 80% or even higher on their pure software business. And yes, they make a few Xboxes and even tablets, but it's a tiny, tiny part of their business. So they are really a pure digital software company, very heavily driven by network effects. But the other thing that I think that they've discovered is they can take advantage of the smartphone or the mobile world just by selling cloud services. And this was a very hard, let's say, emotional business transition to make, because selling packaged software seemed to be such a profitable business model. And moving toward software as a service, small payments, just takes lots of years to build up. But eventually, the profits are enormous, and they're very recurring. So it's just taken a transition for Microsoft to move its enterprise products to the web, the Azure online development platform and cloud platform. And many companies today are now building applications in Azure. So it's become like the Windows of the web. And initially, I think Microsoft priced it too high and didn't have a lot of tools available for development on the web, particularly for small companies. And so the more popular development environment was Linux. But over time, as the big enterprise users have switched to the cloud, I mean, they're all Microsoft users for the most part in their back offices or on their desktops or in email. And so they've just found it convenient to switch to the web. So we have to give the credit there to Satya Nadella. So in many ways, missing the smartphone platform itself didn't really hurt them, because Google gives away the operating system for free. So, you know, what could Microsoft charge? And that's part of the reason Microsoft failed in the smartphone area. It always tried to charge. It also tried to cram desktop Windows onto a handheld device, and it didn't work in terms of interface or power usage, and the Intel chips didn't work well in handheld devices because they used too much power at that time. It took a while for them to catch up. So a whole bunch of factors made it difficult for Microsoft to do well on the mobile devices. But of course, if Apple had not come up with the iPhone, they probably would have done pretty well. They had 25% market share with the most modern smartphones before the iPhone came out. So the iPhone kind of destroyed the business of a lot of companies, or the hopes of a lot of companies, including BlackBerry, for example, and Nokia, not just Microsoft. But again, Microsoft has recovered incredibly well. I don't think anybody foresaw how much of a cloud company they would become. But if you look at the background of Satya Nadella, he grew up, again, using the cloud. So he was not tied to Windows. He didn't have his legs tied around Windows and could do other things. He's completely changed the culture of Microsoft to be more of a open platform company and a mobile platform company and applications company and not just a Windows company.
That is Michael Cusimano, co-author of the book, The Business of Platforms, Strategy in the Age of Digital Competition, Innovation, and Power. Coming up next, Uber, and why the ride-hailing giant is actually not the greatest example of the kind of platform you would want to build. You talk at length about Uber as a platform company. What makes Uber different as a platform company, or is it different?
One of the things that makes Uber different is it's a bad platform. And by bad, I mean that a platform should be solving some type of market imperfection. And so where there's not enough supply to meet a particular demand. And we also talk about this in the book. It's platforms, all platforms, transaction or innovation, they bring different market sides together. They have to solve what we call the chicken or egg problem and get the momentum going. And one way to solve that is to subsidize one side or the other. You could, for example, make access to the platform free. In the Microsoft case, they did that for applications. Or you can pay, or you can keep prices below the market price. So unfortunately, the problem with Uber is that it's in too many markets. There are some markets where there's not enough transportation, not enough taxi cabs, for example. But to be in every market in the world, like to be the Amazon of transportation, is, again, to replicate the world market for taxi cabs or ride sharing, and it's not necessarily a good market. And if you digitize and globalize that business approach, and instead of just losing thousands of dollars, you can lose billions of dollars. And essentially, that's what Uber's doing. It's subsidizing both sides. It's keeping the price for riders below the market price, which is the taxi cab price. It's also paying bonuses. I just got an email the other day, you know, £3 off my next ride in London. It also subsidizes the driver side. So in other words, rather than just pay commissions, it also pays drivers a separate fee. And that's become enormously costly. The other problem with Uber, and this was brought out by a consulting firm who looked at their pre-IPO documents, about 13% of Uber drivers in the last couple of years have been quitting each month. Hmm. And it costs Uber $650 to replace a driver. They have to advertise and do other things. So they have about 3 million drivers in the past when we wrote the book, and they're up to about 4 million now. So in other words, they're spending several hundred million dollars per month just to replace all those drivers. So if you think about it, every 8 months or so, they have to replace all of their 3 million drivers. At least that's the way it was in the last 2 years. So they're losing about, or it's costing them about $3 billion a year in the past just to replace drivers. And this is not any other subsidy. And now with 4 million drivers, they're up to about $4 billion in costs. So they're going to lose, just from the get-go, $4 billion this year. So, you know, it's a terrible platform. It's not a good business, and it never was a good business. The only way for them to make money is actually to just scale back and go into markets where there's enough demand where they don't have to subsidize both sides of their marketplace, the riders and the drivers, and it doesn't, and they don't have so much turnover of drivers. Again, they're taking advantage of not employing drivers, just hiring them as contractors, but here's the double-edged sword for them. It's extraordinarily high turnover. So, right, can you imagine a business operating if they're losing 100% of their workers every 8 months or every 9 months? It would be disastrous, and that's what you see with Uber.
Is scaling back the only option to make it a good platform?
So the other thing they've been doing is to try to find niches where they could charge a little more. So like restaurant food delivery, Uber Eats. But, you know, again, delivering food is also not a particularly good business. And there's also a lot of alternatives for restaurants. I noticed recently Amazon had started in that business, and then they quit it. Mm-hmm. It's not a good business. So they may be able to make a little bit more money in certain markets by partnering with restaurants and getting some scale there. So it's better than nothing. But, again, and I would warn investors, even if they make that successful, what kind of profit margins do you think Uber can generate? I mean, they're still going to be tiny, and they're still going to be a pittance compared to what Microsoft or Google or Facebook can generate from selling digital ads or selling software. So Uber is a bad business. It never was a good business. And let me say that Airbnb is also a transaction platform, but a very different business model. And Airbnb always makes money because it doesn't have to subsidize anybody. It just provides access to assets that people have in which they may decide to rent if there's demand in their market. So Airbnb is a great example of a profitable platform, and we should see more of those. And then that's where I think entrepreneurs and investors should focus, finding platforms with that kind of business model. And even though they're both transaction platforms, the demand-supply balance they're attacking is very different.
You alluded before to the next big platforms, which could go beyond internet services, things like CRISPR gene editing and quantum computing. Are these two the most likely candidates to be the sources of big platforms in the future?
Well, we chose quantum computing because it's a new type of innovation platform and also has transaction platform capabilities. It actually is being sold already. You can buy quantum computing as a service from a company called D-Wave in Canada or even from IBM. And Google and Microsoft and several other companies have kind of emulation quantum computing services available through their cloud platforms. But we're still in the period where quantum computing is like computers were maybe in the late 1940s or around 1950. It's just a few companies. They're still very close to science. But the power of a quantum computer is just mind-boggling. And so we will be able to do things, very specialized applications with quantum computers in the future that are just impossible with current architectures. So it is going to be an important computing platform, and that's why you see every major government and even every major computer company and other technology companies investing pretty heavily in quantum computers. But we're still 10 years, 20 years away, I think, from applications that the average person might come across, let's say, in cryptography or secure communications. Other kinds of simulation applications are being used already by scientists, or if you're calculating routes for traffic, for example, quantum computers can do things in seconds that would take months to do in a conventional computer. The problem is you need several months to program the quantum computer first at this point. But all these things will change. Think of how computers have advanced between 1950 and 2019. So you're going to see advances in quantum computing. So we do think this is important, and we need to talk about it and actually in some ways think of regulating parts of it, because you're going to see quantum computers being able to create unbreakable cryptography silos, for example, data that no one can break. And so we have to think about that. And something like gene editing is important as well. This is a more open technology that a lot of companies are using, but there are ecosystems emerging around gene editing technologies like CRISPR, and we're seeing kind of a value chain from diagnostic tools to reusable libraries of components, and then other companies creating therapies around some of these components. And so it's the more researches you have, the more applications you have, the more tools you have, the more investment you have. So there's kind of there are network effects going on as well. So we think it's an important example of platforms and ecosystems and network effects that's not specifically related to information technology, a different type of technology. And there are others that I mentioned. We think self-driving cars and some other areas of artificial intelligence and machine learning applications, some other peer-to-peer technologies, also have a lot of platform characteristics. We haven't talked about Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies, but these are all platform-like technologies, and they live or die according to network effects. And some can be very powerful very quickly, and some can also become powerful and then just disappear very quickly as well.
Well, this is great. It's always fun for me to catch up with your work. As I mentioned at the beginning, I feel like I've gained new insights over the years through your books. And even though I've never been in a class of yours, I almost feel like I've gone to the Michael Cusimano School of Business Technology and Platforms collectively.
Okay, thank you.
One of the things I appreciate about your new book is that it continues your data-driven approach. And for example, you and your colleagues look at the revenue and the profits of the different types of platform companies. Big picture, though, from the data or from some of your research, was there one thing that just really surprised you that would be a key takeaway from the book that would be a good insight for folks to know before they read?
So key takeaways, let's go back to the data. Most people talk about these platforms, but I was surprised to learn that no one had actually collected any real data on multiple platforms. And so this was the first example of trying to create a database of all the, at least publicly listed, platforms that existed and look at their performance. So fortunately, they turned out to be very profitable, very successful. So we were surprised, but it did make sense that platforms compared to a control sample of firms in the same industries were about, they generated roughly the same amount of revenues, like about $4.5 billion on average, but platforms did it with half the number of employees. And they were also twice as profitable and also much more valuable, several times more valuable. So the whole excitement over platforms is in many ways justified. So if you can make it to this magical level of being a multi-billion dollar public company, you probably have a very lucrative business. But along the way, there's a lot of failures, and we also tried to count failures. So on the one hand, we were surprised at how financially successful our sample of platforms were, but you have to expect a lot of failures along the way. And I guess the other surprise was the failures along the way, that so many investors keep investing and throwing money at platforms that are bad businesses. And you know, again, Uber is the poster child for that. But the bottom line, again, platformizing a bad business doesn't make it a good business. And when we look at the wildly successful platforms and financially very profitable platforms, they are inherently good businesses. None of them are bad businesses. So I think, again, that's an important point to think about. So not just jump onto what we call the platform mania bandwagon, but really think about what are you investing? What is the underlying business, and is it good or bad? So those are, I think, some key takeaways from the book.
Well, Michael Cusimano, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Okay. Thank you, Todd.
Michael Cusimano is the Sloan Management Review Distinguished Professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management. He's the author, with Annabelle Gower and David Yaffe, of the new book, The Business of Platforms: Strategy in the Age of Digital Competition, Innovation, and Power. You can find a link in the show notes on this podcast or on the related article at geekwire.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop, and we'll talk to you next time on the GeekWire podcast.